I love January. Despite its gray tendencies, I relish the fresh start, the hopeful certainty that last year's inadequacies can be redressed by what comes next, that this year's surprises will be of the pleasant variety. After the indulgences of the holidays, I'm craving energy-giving, mood-lifting food. And in keeping with the usual January spirit, I'm also resolved to get fitter and healthier. No more joking, I'll have two, one for each thigh. So what in the world to eat in this new year, this new decade? With what we learned in 2019 about climate change, biodiversity loss, plastics in our oceans, food waste, and the obesity crisis, the question, what should I eat, is more pressing and less purely personal than it's ever been. It's hard enough to know what's best to do for oneself, much less to carry through with acting on it. But how do we know what to do for our world as a whole and our patch of it? How do we trust to what's ethical and sustainable and recognize what's just pretending to be? There are so many heartbreaking emergencies, so many mixed messages, so much fervor that we could be in danger of making mistakes even with the best intentions, or simply sticking our heads in the sand, or diving into a bucket of donuts. There are certain home truths that can anchor us. Eating a diet rich in vegetables, fruit, and whole grains is very good for us. They get fiber and a rainbow of nutrients into us, help regulate our blood sugar, and are good for our gut health. They also keep us from eating too much of the wrong thing, like excess sugar and too much processed foods, which we know contribute to making us fatter and more ill. We know that less and better is also the watchword for meat, and more of us who eat meat are ever more discerning about where to source it. We know that tackling climate change, biodiversity loss, and many human diseases requires us to reform how we feed ourselves. To this end, the government is launching a comprehensive study to help develop the first national food strategy this nation has had since World War II. It commissioned food entrepreneur Henry Dimbleby, founder of the Leon Change, to look at the UK's food system in its entirety, consulting with every branch of government and in every region of the country, with farmers, scientists, manufacturers, the transport industry, wholesalers and retailers, health professionals, conservationists, educators, and the British public, to inform policies that will reform our current food system. The aim, it says, is to promote better health for us and our environment, and to ensure our food security. For as much as our current food system offers us in terms of unprecedented choice, convenience, and employment, 1 in 8 of us in the UK works in the sector, it's widely accepted that our food system does harm as well as good and is riddled with unintended consequences. The global food supply chain is responsible for 20-30% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. In the UK itself, production emissions are under 20%. But if what we consume from imported food is added to this, the total rises. With the increasing use of the world's land for agriculture, we've lost global habitats and wildlife at devastating rates. In the UK, songbirds decreased in numbers by 54% between 1966 and 2008. That's just 42 years. And almost all of our wildlife meadows have disappeared, and half our ancient woodlands. And too much of what our global food system produces is either wasted or making us fatter and more ill. In his address to the Oxford Farming Conference earlier this month, Henry Dimbleby reported that 18 of the world's largest food companies rely on food and drink portfolios in which 85% of products are regarded as so unhealthy they can't, under World Health Organization guidelines, be marketed to children. It is to be hoped that sound national food policies will result from this initiative, and it appears to be widely greeted as an opportunity for more solid evidence to come forth and more collaboration, and for the nuances and complexities of these challenges to be aired more thoughtfully and clearly by a range of voices who will help us understand the facts and choices we face. Some of these big picture questions will affect all our lives. What role do we want government to play in what we eat? How do we want to use our land? How do we get the most out of it while restoring and sustaining soil health, human health, ecosystems, and wildlife? And what will our landscape look like in a decade, a century? What will our food taste like? With all these critical challenges, will taste get a look in? Will breeders select for varieties with flavor? Will farmers be empowered to grow such crops? Taste is so often superior in those fruits, vegetables, and meat that are given time, as well as all the right conditions, to grow and mature. And time, of course, needs to be reflected in the price of food. Is that a reality we are ready to accept? I'm glad that this initiative acknowledges the pleasure afforded by food, the social value of eating together, the heritage and culture implicit in our food. Whatever choices we need to make individually, as a nation, and globally, there are ways to factor in flavor and ways to factor it out. That's always a risk. It's happened often, it happens now, and we need to be alert to that as we debate how to reform the system. Good-tasting varieties of fruits and vegetables and breeds of meat, all grown well with respect for the land, the crops and animals, and those who will one day be eating them, are anything but frivolous considerations. Flavor isn't just an indulgence, the privilege of a few. A bias for flavor is built into our biology as part of our reward system. This can get us into trouble, but it can also help us get out of it. Plenty of research shows that we make food choices based more than anything on what tastes good to us, and that efforts to eat less and better work best when food brings us pleasure. We have many local resources here in Cambridgeshire afforded by those growers, retailers, cooperatives, and chefs who are doing a great service in producing and showcasing all manner of local produce grown sustainably and for superior flavor. I'll be visiting all my favorite local haunts this year for plums, apricots, cherries, soft fruit, apples, pears, celery, tomatoes, asparagus, and all manner of other vegetables, salad crops, and herbs grown right here. I'm delighted to see fresh produce getting more attention right now and being used so creatively as the centerpiece of a meal as well as the supporting act. And I'm excited at the signs that British farmers will respond to the growing interest in plant-based diets by growing more of the less common vegetables too, like salsify and artichokes. And if, like me, you are an omnivore aiming to eat less and better meat, you should know about the local producers who rear small, well-husbanded herds of special breed cattle on pasture in and around Cambridge. These passionate livestock farmers could not be more different from the intensive animal farming we've seen reported that relies on huge soy-dependent feedlots that displace rainforest. Angelica von Heimendahl's 60 red pole cattle are a familiar sight on Midsummer Common in the city and in the water meadows between Grantchester and the river. Angelica is one of few commoner farmers who still raise cattle on common land, as many commons around the country were lost in the 18th and 19th centuries with the Enclosure Acts. She's a member of the Pasture for Life movement that works to reduce the carbon footprint of cattle farming, and her red poles are fed exclusively on grass with no need for resource-intensive cereal feeds. They forage on the meadow for 9 months of the year, helping to keep the habitat from deteriorating into bramble. And in the winter, they're moved indoors and fed on hay, dried grass, and silage, fermented grass. She sells the meat throughout the year through her business, Cam Cattle, at the Cambridge Market on Sundays. Sam Taylor of Little Linton Farm also raises red poles, that beautiful mahogany brown breed native to this region. He sells his beef in mixed cuts by the box at the farm gate to a waiting list of customers who prize it for its deeper, beefier flavor and well-marbled texture. Sam explained that a lot of other breeds need grain to bring them to the required weight quickly, but cows are bred to eat grass and a grain-rich diet gives their meat a different fat composition, lower in the essential fatty acids that are healthier for humans. His animals, like Angelica's, are fed purely on grass and given time to mature at their own pace, typically 24 to 30 months or longer, as opposed to 16 to 18 months for more conventionally reared cattle. Sam grazes his low-density herd in rotation on pasture land where they browse not only grasses, but the wild herbs, nettles, brambles, and legumes that also support pollinators and other wildlife. There's no need for fertilizers, and the pastures extend down to the water meadows along the River Granta, creating a corridor for nature. You can buy another special breed of beef from Robert Twigden's Longhorn Farm Shop in Cottenham, where he sells the meat from these handsome brown and white cattle raised by farmer Stephen White. Recognized by their distinctive downturned horns, this 17th century breed has become until recently scarce in the British countryside. But thanks to the Rare Breed Survival Trust and people like Stephen and Robert, it is once again being grown more widely for its superior flavor. You can buy it and the lamb also grown on Cuckoo Farm there at the shop. For people who want meat in their diet, supporting producers like these is a positive way to encourage responsible livestock farming while enjoying a special product. There is an environmental cost to everything we eat, plant or animal, land or sea. We have a good opportunity right now to learn, to distinguish between the very different production systems for all these food groups, from intensive monoculture to greenhouse grown to organic methods, and with livestock, from intensive mass production feedlots to small herds reared on permanent pasture or on mixed farms where they have an important role in improving soils, or on highlands and other terrain that can't support other kinds of agriculture where grazing animals have shaped the landscape for generations. So this new year, I'll be shopping with my reusable bags, buying a little less, seeking out honest food from friendly producers, and asking more questions. It takes effort, but procuring what we eat can be a chore or a pleasure, so whenever I can, I'll be making it as fun and social a way of spending time as I can. I'm also hoping, as Mr. Dimbleby says, for more light and less heat on the hard questions we all face, so we understand better the complex interrelationships we have with our food and food system, and can make informed decisions about how to influence it and our own health. I'm sure this new year will be a delicious one here in Cambridge, and maybe 2020 will also be the year of better focus when we see more clearly.